Today, we are in our continued celebration of the Billion Dollar Unicorns Entrepreneur Journeys book. We have a very special guest, Therese Tucker, CEO, founder of Black Lion Systems. Welcome, Therese. It's a real pleasure to have you on, and we don't have as many women entrepreneurs as I would like to see, and I'm thrilled to have you on the show today.
Sumana, thank you so much. And we are going to have more women entrepreneurs. That's what this is about, right?
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. So, folks, let me introduce you to Therese. She's got an amazing background. When I first met her in 2009, she had bootstrapped Black Lion to about $10 million. And then she continued to bootstrap for a while, and eventually, right around 2013, raised a significant amount of money from Silver Lake, which is a private equity firm in the technology industry. So for those of you who have even the faintest doubt that women cannot build successful technology companies, here we have Therese Tucker as a complete, absolute, perfect counterexample of that stupid myth. All right? So that's what I want to set the tone of this session with, that, you know, that main point. So, Therese, let's start by introducing our audience to what you do in Black Lion and how you add value to customers. And that's what this is all about. You have succeeded because you've added tremendous value to your customer base.
That's correct. Thank you, Sumana. Black Lion is a SaaS company based in Southern California, and we build software that replaces all of the things that accountants do in spreadsheets. That's sort of the very, very quick pitch, because what's a bit surprising is that there are companies out there that spend millions and even hundreds of millions sometimes on their ERP systems, and yet there are still dozens of different processes that they end up doing in Excel. With increasing complexity, globalization, compliance regulations, it becomes more and more difficult for companies to actually manage and control, and much less do in real time, these sorts of activities. So Black Lion provides software that really gives them very structured, automated tools to increase their efficiency and their visibility and their control.
And if I remember correctly, one of the key functions that you automate in this mode is the reconciliation of accounts, right? Closing and reconciliation of accounts, which is a cumbersome process. And that's really what, that's the problem that you zeroed in on when you started the company, yes?
Yes, that's exactly right. Good memory. we started with
Therese, I can tell you this, you were absolutely memorable.
Well, am I memorable now with the pink hair, Sumana?
Well, you've made a big change to hairstyle and hair color, actually.
I was tired of gray.
I'm actually wondering how your customers look at your pink hair.
You know what? I think I'll reflect what my board said, which is if you keep doing what you're doing, you can color your hair any color you want.
Wonderful. I love the message. So, Therese, talk a little bit about your bootstrapping phase, because, you know, I kind of want to highlight this as one of the ways that a lot of women entrepreneurs have not only women entrepreneurs, all entrepreneurs have been successful in mitigating what we call the capital gap in the early stages. And there's been a lot of media reporting that women don't get funding and blah, blah, blah. My take on this is if women entrepreneurs build value, validate, and prove that they can sell to customers and have a large market opportunity, high velocity, large market opportunity, I don't think there is any problem with funding. And you are a great example of that mantra, what we call bootstrap first, raise money later mantra. Diane Greene built VMware with exactly that principle. Julia Hart founder of Eventbrite, has talked extensively and given lots of interviews emphasizing that very strategy of bootstrap first, validate, prove that your model is working, and then go scale the company with investor money. You have obviously followed exactly that textbook strategy. Talk a little bit about what was it like when you were starting out and you were making these decisions. What prompted those decisions? What were the circumstances? What were your early days like?
You know, I also believe in that methodology because once you've done that, one of the things that we have in our culture is just we're incredibly efficient. Because when you bootstrap a company, every dollar that you spend, you say, what is this dollar going to get me in revenue? I mean, you look at flying coach, you look at booking in advance, you look at every trade show. Every dollar spent is spent very, very carefully. Now, I did not do that from a place of wisdom. I did that from a place of ignorance. I simply wanted to build a company. I had no idea how to fundraise. It's not a friendly environment at all. And I really, it was a good way to do it, but it is stressful. There are, you know, I started out with some seed money from my prior employer, from my options there. So I spent all that. I liquidated my savings. I liquidated my 401k. I maxed out, or I took out a second mortgage on my home. And eventually I ended up maxing out my credit cards. It was a long haul. And finally, I got down to, I was borrowing payroll loans from my board members to make payroll every couple months. And so, you know, when you start borrowing money from friends, it's a very stressful experience because you don't want to ruin your friendships by borrowing money. And so, especially money that you might not pay back. But I mean, if you look at it ultimately, you know, I ended up holding a very large share of the company for a very long time. I, you know, with the Silver Lake investment, which we really did simply for liquidity, I no longer have to work if I don't want to. It is completely optional at this point in my life, which is a lovely place to be because, you know, I always said I was doing it because I loved it, but now I really is the truth. So it's stressful, but it brings great efficiencies. And you end up, and the reward at the end is much, 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 much bigger. So I like the way we did it.
Right. So, and that's actually true about a lot of situations that end up being, you know, great success stories. Lynda.com, Lynda just sold her company for $1.5 billion, and this is 20 years after she started. In the middle of that journey, at points, that company almost went out of business because what they were doing was very early in the market. You know, this whole video learning at the time, it's hard for you to imagine today, but it was a time before ubiquitous broadband. Lynda started her company in 1995. So when you have a long-term vision and you kind of stay with that vision, and in a lot of cases, as you're describing, Therese, as Lynda has experienced, there weren't a lot of options. It's not like investors were beating on your door to give you money. The only kind of money at that stage that you can access is, as we call, the three Fs, friends, family, and fools. And that is very stressful money, but that's the only kind of money that is accessible at that point. So for those of you who are somehow misled by the media's reporting of entrepreneurship, that this is something where you make, you know, overnight success and overnight millionaires and billionaires, this is really not what it's about. There are very few of those. There are a few who get incredibly lucky by being at the right place at the right time, but those are few and far between. The journey that Therese is describing of incredibly stressful many, many years is more the norm of entrepreneurship. And it is, you know, if you want a safe life, if you want a comfortable life, if you want a secure life, this is not the path you should be taking. Entrepreneurship is not for everybody. And that is a message that people need to kind of understand and internalize, because today kind of the media says that entrepreneurship is for everybody. I personally do not believe that, and I think Therese is telling you that you really have to have nerves of steel to be able to do this right. Now, let's double-click down a little bit on your, you know, the phase at which you did choose to raise money. What was happening in the industry? I think it was about 2013 that you
actually
raised money.
It started a little bit before that. We did close in 2013, but around 2012, you know, it didn't feel like, given the massive market that we have in front of us, it didn't feel like we were growing as quickly as we could or should.
What was your growth rate at that time?
Well, actually, this last year in 2014, our growth rate was 50% again, which was the eighth year of at least 50% growth year over year. So we've never grown less than 50% year over year. But again, you know, part of growth rate is the market that you're addressing. And so just looking at it, you know, why were we only growing 50%? I thought maybe, you know, maybe I didn't have what it took. Maybe I was tired. And I thought, boy, I've been doing this a long time. And maybe it's time to sell it. And I initially thought that I would sell it to a strategic. And my banker at Evercore said, you really need to bring in private equity as well, because they'll bring the price up. Well, a couple things happened during that process. I didn't fall in love with any of the strategics, and I became worried about what was going to happen to BlackLine if we ended up joining a strategic. Well, I look at 50% growth year over year and go, that's not very much. It's more now that the numbers are bigger. But it was, you know, we would have just died at the slowness of 20% year over year. I mean, everybody would have been bored and left. So I sort of fell out of love with the idea of, you know, going with a strategic. And at the same time, I also got re-energized by our vision and what we wanted to do. And I decided that I wasn't ready to retire.
Okay.
At that point, it became an exercise to look at who would make the best partner. And we had a lot of different suitors. You know, at that point, massive market. We had ended 2012 with $25 million. In revenue. We had planned on doing $37 million in revenue for 13, which is what we did. And, you know, we had great customers. We have just incredibly well-known customers that use BlackLine globally. We had many levers for growth. So all of these things made us a very attractive target.
An opportunity.
We ended up selecting Silver Lake Sumeru. And, you know, Holly Moore Mahanes and John Brennan and Jason Babcoke led that process. And, by the way, Holly was the only woman in the entire process, which was, we realized later that we had a woman private equity managing director, we had a woman CEO, and we had a woman lead attorney on it, which was kind of fun. But we didn't think about that at the time, because it's not about gender. It's about... It was about finding the best partner.
It's about competence.
Yes. We closed that deal in September of 2013. We received a valuation of greater than $200 million. I was quite pleased with that. And the ongoing partnership with Silver Lake has been everything I wanted and more. They have been tremendously helpful in bringing in some incredibly top talent that has helped us to scale. We are still growing at 50% year over year. The company is in a position now where we can continue to scale and grow and do amazing things for years to come because of this partnership. I have been so pleased with every part of what we've done.
And you said earlier that you also took some liquidity at that point for yourself, which put you in a very comfortable financial position. What was the composition of the deal? How much did you raise? How much went into growth, and how much did you take off the table?
Actually, Blackline is still self-sustaining in terms of cash. We didn't put any money on the balance sheet because we already had plenty of cash.
Okay.
So instead, we simply allowed all of the employees and board members and myself who had stock to have liquidity. You know, many of us rolled over some shares, but in general, it was really about, you know, how do we scale this to the next level?
Yeah, but it's also, I think this is a very common point in an entrepreneur's journey, especially entrepreneurs like you who have been at it for many, many years. It's not like you raised money and 4 years later you were, you know, flushed with venture capital. That's not your journey. Your journey, you started Blackline in what, 2001?
We started Blackline in 2001. Everything we had built, we basically threw away in 2004 and switched markets. And now we're, you know, completely in the same market that we're in now. But we essentially rebooted completely and came up with a new product in 2005. So it has been a long journey.
All of which is emotionally extremely tough. So by the time 2013 rolled along, you were 12 years into this process.
And hard the whole time.
So it, you know, you can, listeners, you can understand, you know, 12 years into a process, the company has reached a certain level of scale. $37 million is nothing to jeer at. And at this point, there are options. Obviously, in Teresa's journey, there are options. And one of those options was to take liquidity for herself, for her early board members and investors and employees, and then, but still continue to build. And I think the point that I want to probe next is this point of retirement. There's this stupid idea in people's heads that, oh, I'm going to sell my shares and my company, and I'm going to retire, and I'm going to have such a good time. Well, is retirement that much fun? What do? Retirement is a boring concept.
It is a boring concept. I completely agree. And how much fun is it to actually build a company into something that ultimately could go public? Like from zero and nothing to this thing that ultimately will be listed on some exchange. That's the most fun. And, you know, material things, it's great to not worry about bills. It's a wonderful thing, but it's not why I get up in the morning.
Yeah, and I think that's a very subtle and an important point for people to remember is that, you know, I have seen so many, because I've been in the Silicon Valley environment for a long, long time, you know, 20 years, it's people have this dream that, oh, I'm going to sell my company, I'm going to be showered with a huge amount of cash, and I will never have to work again, and they turn into zombies. And this is not this is not a recipe for happiness. Happiness requires that you have meaningful, intellectually challenging stuff going on in your life on a daily basis so that you have a reason to wake up and even some stress, right? Running a business is a stressful affair, whether it's, you know, early on or later on, there are different kinds of stresses, but there's stress involved, and that stress actually keeps you on your toes, and it's kind of necessary. It is a necessary ingredient of having a successful, meaningful, happy life. So the reason I'm probing this point is just to kind of highlight for those of you who are, you know, listening to this either live or in the recording, revisit your notion and your expectation of, you know, selling your company early on and then, you know, then what? Then what is the question that you should be asking yourself. So, Therese, talk to us about the topic of women and entrepreneurs. The media is sensationalizing this topic very heavily right now. For the last year, I've seen this, you know, kind of dominating the zeitgeist of the media, and the line that is making rounds is there is a bias against women entrepreneurs. What is your point of view?
You know, I have certainly encountered some weird things over the years. But I've never, that's not stopped me. I mean, an entrepreneur, by definition, will encounter difficulties. And the reason that you're successful is because you persist through those difficulties. And so if you find someone, and they are out there, if you find someone that has just extreme bias against women, then you drop that person from your life, then you take a different route. And so, yes, the bias exists, but why would you focus on it? I mean, why wouldn't you focus on the things that you need to do to build a successful business? Who cares what anybody else thinks?
Well, there are obstacles, whether you're a male entrepreneur or a female entrepreneur, there are obstacles. That's what this whole thing is about. This is a very, very difficult thing to do, is to build something out of nothing. So so what you're saying is there are, you know, there are gender bias related obstacles that come up, and the way you deal with it is just either sidestep it, you know, you kind of don't deal with the kinds of people who present those obstacles, or you figure out some other way to navigate around it and then move on. Basically.
Right.
And I think coming back to the methodology that is repeatable and that works for pretty much everybody is that if you can bootstrap your way to showing that your business is actually working, that's where this bias becomes a lot less relevant and a lot less significant, because at the end of the day, especially if you're working with investors, investors are coin-operated. Investors want to make money. If you show them how to make money, and if they think that you are going to help them make money, trust me, there is no bias against that. Absolutely none.
Exactly right.
So where to from here? You are in 2015. You have, where are you revenue-wise at this point?
Well, again, as I mentioned, we did grow at another 50% in 14. Now I'm going to switch from revenue to ARR. So we ended the year with about $65 million in ARR, and we're shooting for another 50% growth this year. So I'd sure love to get to $100 million in revenue pretty soon.
Yep. And you have
in annual recurring revenue. Excuse me, in bookings.
Okay. Yeah. ARR is annual recurring revenue, and MRR is monthly recurring revenue. These are two metrics that are very important metrics for software as a service companies, for those of you who are not familiar with this terminology. So now you are, you know, just kind of back of the envelope, you are in an unicorn league, I would say, right? If you were valued today for a funding round or an IPO, you're approaching unicorn valuation numbers, yes?
I think that's probably true. Given that we are the leader in our category, you know, you could put a healthy multiple on that revenue and probably get to pretty quickly the unicorn status. I kind of hate the term though.
Yeah.
But yeah, we would, you know, I guess I'm not focused on the term. I'm focused on building a business that has long-term sustainable value. And
yeah.
So a unicorn sounds like something that's going to go poof. I don't want a poof. I want a business that people's mortgages and lives and tuitions can solidly rely on, and my investors, that they can get a solid return for years and years to come. That's why I don't like the term unicorn, because I don't want it to be mythical, and I don't want it to go poof.
Well, the place where the unicorn concept came from is that it's very rare. Now, it turns out that in this last year or year and a half, the late stage venture market has gotten into a complete bubble. So instead of unicorns being rare, they've become ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm.
There are too many private unicorns, quote unquote, that I believe are not going to sustain in the public market because they don't have fundamentals. You know, they're kind of running on bubbles, and this is going to, you know, this kind of momentum is not going to last in the public market, because the public market right now is not in a bubble. The public market is a healthy, you know, fundamental-driven market. So if you have a company that is raising hundreds of millions of dollars and is not showing revenues to track with the kind of valuations it's raising money in, it's not going to sustain in the public market. So what, in terms of your requirements as far as growth is concerned, do you need more financing, or you have enough, you're generating enough cash internally that you can go public at this point with what you have?
You know, there's a couple questions there. We are generating plenty of cash, which is great. We certainly will look at an IPO as a very viable option, because obviously we'd love to give all of our investors liquidity at some point. And the other thing to always consider is, how much do you want to invest in growth when you do have a massive market, right?
Yeah.
With very little penetration. We've, over the last couple of years, we've expanded a great deal into APAC. We have about 14 people in London now. We just recently, a few weeks ago, I was in Paris to launch our Paris operations. Later this year, we'll be moving into Germany. So, you know, those international expansions are expensive, and yet we know that there's a market for our software internationally, so why not go after it? So, you know, there may be capital requirements down the road that, you know, we may at some point take funding to make sure that we can grow at the rate that we want to grow. But again, coming from that bootstrap mentality, it's also about spending well and spending efficiently. So if we do that, we will have a plan in place so that we make sure that we generate a return off of that capital.
Right. And there's no rush to go public. You know, being public is actually a royal pain. So as all your customers probably know very well, that being public is not exactly a walk in the park. So if you can delay that, and the public market is very, the private market is very robust right now, and if you can raise plenty of money, if you need more capital to sustain your growth, and sounds like you have a very disciplined approach to spending capital and aligning that with the fundamentals and so forth. So it sounds like you're building a very robust, very kind of fundamentally solid company, and that's the message that I want to leave our audience with, is that this really is the type of company to build. Please do not get seduced by this WhatsApp kind of deals where, you know, with no revenue, you get a huge multiple on your acquisition. This does not happen very often. And the risk, it's extremely capital intensive to do stuff like that. Very few people get the opportunity to do it. And it's really like playing a lottery. Whereas the approach that Therese has discussed with you today in this session is something that is more deliberate and more repeatable. I think this is more the type of business that if you kind of aim at following a methodology, her methodology of doing things deliberately, going after a market that has real pain and real opportunity, customers looking for solutions, this is more the kind of role model you should be looking for. So thank you, Therese. I love the pink hair, and I'm delighted to see this. Hair color can be anything, as long as you're solving customer problems. Your message is lovely. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Sermana. Really, I thank you for the opportunity. Bye now.
See you again soon.